Gosh, I haven't seen you for hours. Before we introduce our authors, I would like to introduce you to Damon Hill. Damon is the public service manager for the Marin County Free Library and has been a passionate librarian and advocate for libraries for over 20 years. He's been children's librarian, head of reference, branch manager, you name it, something needs to be done in the library, and Damon has done it or is doing it. He believes that libraries possess a unique opportunity to empower individuals to transform the community in which they live. And what could be more One Book, One Marin than Damon's statement? So please welcome Damon Hill.
Thank you. In 1998, the Washington Center for the Books hosted author Russell Banks for 4 days of programs and discussion about his novel, The Sweet Hereafter. Since then, communities all over have increasingly embraced the notion of civic unity through reading of literature. There are now citywide, countywide, statewide, and even countrywide reading programs all over the world. One Book, One Marin started in 2007 with the goal of bringing the county of Marin together through the reading and discussion of a common book, and has continued to grow through this year's selection, A Night We Walk in Circles. We like to call ourselves Marin's Biggest Book Club. One Book, One Marin builds a stronger, enriched community through library programs, community dialogue, and through the exploration of literature and culture. The programs this year have been very well attended, and the book has received very high praise throughout the entire community. We would like to give very sincere thanks to Book Passages and Dominican University for joining the Marin County Free Library as founding partners. We'd also like to thank our city libraries for joining along in this endeavor. I want to extend a special appreciation to our community partners and librarians who work each year to bring interesting programming of events, and our financial sponsors who make it possible this year. Finally, we would like to make a very special recognition to our platinum sponsors, Susan and Dennis Giraldi. This is the 4th year of supporting One Book, One Marin. Thank you so much, Susan and Dennis. And now, back to Elaine.
I get to do a lot tonight. It's a good thing I like it.
Well, and we have wonderful, so many wonderful financial supporters who make it possible for us to have this event. So to all of you, thank you. Whether you support us financially or just with helping us make this happen, we're so happy. And one person who has supported One Book, One Marin for the entire 9 years, from the first authors, Isabel Allende, Michael Chabon, Abraham Verghese, so many authors, has been the wonderful Dr. Michael Krasny. As you know, Dr. Krasny is a professor at San Francisco State University, where he is adored by his students and has nurtured the writing of many, many people who then end up at our store reading their published work, which is pretty exciting. His own works include Off Mic, a memoir of TV, radio, of talk radio and literary life, which I have to tell you really dishes it, so you probably don't want to read that. And Spiritual Envy, both of which were on the Chronicle bestseller list. He does have a book coming out in the fall. It's going to be a serious work, as well as a very funny book, because it's going to center on Jewish humor, of which he is a true expert. He's received many, many awards, gold medals, journalism awards, but I like to remember where he got his start as a radio talk show host. I love to listen to Forum. I know I'm going to be challenged. I know I'm going to have a fascinating morning, and I'm not going to care if I'm stuck in traffic. I love that. But I love that people call in from all over the world under our new world. But he got his start right here in Marin, where he lives, with his first radio show that I know about, which was called something like Beyond the Hot Tub. So I think we can be very proud of his fruits. And it's really thrilling to introduce you to Daniel Alarcón. Daniel was born in Lima, Peru, and grew up in Alabama, of all places. His parents are both doctors. And I don't know if his mother is here or not, but she lives in the Bay Area and is a wonderful reader and supporter. Soon, Daniel and his family will be going to New York, where he will be on the faculty of the Columbia School of Journalism. So our timing was really good here. I have enjoyed and loved every one of his books, War by Candlelight, Lost City Radio, I need to tell you because it makes me proud. Book Passage chose it as our first edition pick when it came out. We pick a book every month that is not yet by an author who's not yet famous. And then it won all the awards. Everyone was giving this book awards. It was one of the best books of the year by all the newspapers. It won the Penn Faulkner Hemingway Award. And every time it won an award, those of us at Book Passage who had been part of that choosing for our little award thought we'd written the book. So it's a problem. His new book we're going to be talking about tonight. As you know, it is set in a South American country. I can't imagine which one. But what I really want to say about it is that I'm so glad that so many of you have had the chance to read it this year. From the launch in February to all the programs that have happened in all of the libraries to people who have just picked it up and enjoyed it, because it deals with politics, it deals with good and evil, it deals with aging parents, it deals with sibling issues, it deals with love. And I think that it's going to be one of those books, if you've read it or you haven't read it yet, that will not leave your mind. It is going to invade your psyche. So it is my thrill to introduce Dr. Michael Krasny and Daniel Alarcón.
Well, thank you all for being here this evening. It's a pleasure for me to be in conversation once again with Daniel Alarcón, especially in public. We've talked a couple times on the radio, and this is not meant as any promotion, but you can go to the archives and hear those interviews. We talked about this book, in fact, when it first came out, but there's much, obviously, to talk about, and I look forward to talking with him. Also, thank you all for being here this evening on a night when the Dodgers and the Giants are playing and the Warriors are beginning a new series. I know that there are many things that often can pull you away, but I'm always impressed with people in Marin coming out to hear an important author and to hear the author talk about his work. And I suspect that one of the questions that usually is asked of you, it was funny, we had a little reception and somebody said, ask him about the narrator, and I will ask, of course, about the narrator, but often asked, why not a name for the narrator and why not a name of the country? You do get that question, questions.
I do.
Often in tandem like that?
Yeah. Well, people most often wonder about the country and why I sort of refuse to name it. In fact, I think it so bedevils people that it actually, there's a blurb from John Lee Anderson on the back of the book where he just decided to name it for us all. And it says, you know, this set in Peru, the, you know, da 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 da. And then I emailed him and I said, John, you know, I never actually say it's Peru, you know, and, you know, he just kind of dismissed my authorial intent with that.
What was your intent?
I think my intent is that it's not Peru, it's my vision of a country. And I think that if you end up putting a name on it, people come to it with certain ideas, they come to it, they think they know, or they read it for veracity as opposed to imagination. They want to know if it's real as opposed to getting sucked into the story. And I think it's something that particularly happens to writers like me, American writers with, you know, a heritage that is outside the United States, where we want to be, people want to read us as if these kind of voices of authenticity. I want you to read it as a work of literature. I want you to fall into it in that way, and not necessarily as a treatise on the contemporary history of Peru. Although, of course, there are references to all this.
It's hard not to think of Peru in reading your novel.
Sure, no, I mean, it's fine if you do. It's just that I want to play with contemporary history. I want to play with different aspects of different countries in Latin America, or, you know, current events from other countries that I just want to insert into my fictional landscape.
You want to have your, I think Faulkner called Yakna Potavakani his postage stamp of, it was, yeah. Mississippi, it was obvious it was Mississippi, but it wanted it to be his Mississippi.
Yeah, sure, sure. I mean, not to be, you know, I wouldn't, you know, I think we all follow in the footsteps of writers who have lived their creative lives in these invented places, you know. Mentioned Faulkner, of course, there's Macondo, and on and on and on, all these places where people spend their creative lives. I tend to spend it in this city, which is like Lima, but isn't, you know, is like Lima, but is in some ways harsher, in some ways more surreal, but I hope just as alive.
Talk about the narrator, though. I mean, when did he come to you, and why did he come to you in terms of his role in this novel, which becomes central, really?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the point of view.
It like a lot of things in the creative process, it was an accident, I think. It's important to note. And it was an accident that then became critical to the development of the book and also gave me no small amount of headaches. I would wake up in the middle of the night and ask my wife, she was like, why are you awake? What's going on? I was like, oh, I don't know who's narrating my novel. You know, you can imagine how well that went. So I sort of stumbled upon this I voice in the very first chapter, and I liked it, and I didn't know why. And I thought the narrator was the older brother. I thought the narrator was, you know, I don't know. I had all these kind of harebrained ideas of who the narrator was, and it just took a number of iterations until I figured out his relationship to the story. But I kept it because I felt that the story had sort of two narrative engines. What happened to Nelson, and who's telling this damn story?
Right. It also enabled you to do more with the suspense that clearly you were trying to build, didn't it?
I quite admire suspenseful, hard-boiled detective novels and the tricks that some literary writers look down on. I think they're great. I think that anything you can do to keep people reading, you know, we've all had that experience where you stay up all night reading a book, I want my readers to have that. And yes, there was something about the narrator who knows more than he's letting on. Quite clearly manipulating the reader, but then with these, you know, tips of the hat to tricks in detective novels and whatnot that I quite enjoyed. I mean, you know, and I always come back to this. I think if you're having fun as a writer, then I hope that translates, and the reader is probably going to be having fun as well.
So you had fun writing this book, even though there's some pretty serious and weighty topics, heavy topics, themes?
Yeah, you know, it was hell writing this book. So yes, I did enjoy it, but there were times when I wondered what I was doing. I should say this. I mean, the book was written in two parts. The first part was, say, 2006 to 2010. 2011. To end of 2010, where basically I finished a draft that I ended up throwing away completely.
Total draft.
Yeah. I showed it to some friends. I read it, and I was like, wow, this is really bad, and I showed it to some friends. And it's a story I've told before, but it's worth repeating, I think, because it's, in the end of the day, I'm very proud of it. I was hoping my friends would say, "Yo, you're being hard on yourself, it's not so bad." And in fact, they said, "Daniel, this is terrible. You can't publish this." And those are very good friends, you know.
No, Schadenfreude. These are literary friends, I think.
These are writers. These are writers. These are writers who I respect and admire. And it's a blood pact that you sign with these people. If they're going to be your first readers, and they're going to be honest. And the moment that they tell you it's good when it isn't good is the moment that the pact breaks. And we made this pact, you know, 10 years ago, and it's still strong. You know, longer than 10 years ago, in fact. So at the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, I started over. I threw it all away, and in July, not far from here, actually, at the Headlands, I arrived at the Marin Headlands with nothing. And, you know, six weeks later, I had 120 pages. And it was just, that part was fun. The first week I was researching law schools and just trying to figure out what I was gonna do with my life. And then I learned how to make radio. I learned how to mix radio with this new program that I'd bought. So I did everything except write. And then the second week I turned back to that terrible novel and I selected 6 pages that I liked. And I kept those 6 pages, put them at the front, and then just...
Showed your friends?
No, I showed them a year later when it was done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, how many drafts finally before you sent it off?
Oh, I don't know. It's, you know, because the first 4 years were so hard. I said I had fun. I know I said that, and I'm completely contradicting myself, but...
You can amend that.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's a fun, like, with an asterisk, you know, because... individual scenes were great fun to write. They were funny. I was like, this is terrific. It's moving. And then when you put it together, a novel is not, you know, these kind of the idea of the novel in stories, it's just, it's that doesn't work. A novel has to be greater than the sum of its parts. Each individual scene, you know, good dialogue, snappy descriptions, you know, things are happening, it sounds great, but it doesn't hold together. It's like a building without a foundation. And that was the problem with that draft.
Your love of language is palpable. That may be what you're talking about when you're talking about the fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But so there were a number of times in those 4 years where I would go down a path for 100 something pages and then pause, print it out, read it, and say, "Dear God," and go back 100 pages, toss that out, and go in another direction. So, in all, for this novel, I must have written, you know, 750, 800 pages.
Is prayer an important part of this process? You said, "Dear God."
I think I was substituting that for another phrase. So you seem like nice people. I don't want to offend anybody.
Part of the fun is, you know, there's a kind of a noir quality there.
Yeah.
I mean, were you conscious of that?
I think, you know, you're always conscious of certain things when you're writing, and there's some things that are just happening around you. They're happening to you. They're happening to your characters.
Like the narrator.
Yeah, for example. But I do like... You know, there's a great quote from Mickey Spillane, the crime writer, who said that nobody ever read a novel to get to the middle. And I wholeheartedly subscribe to that idea. And there is a, you know, the city that I describe does have a noir quality to it. It does have this kind of existential gloom that permeates the bricks and the sidewalk and the, you know... the air and the alleyways and the corners and the buses and the people that live there breathe it in all the time. And my characters certainly do. And you know, you can call that noir, you can call it, you know, gloom, you can call it whatever you want, but I felt like there's certainly atmospherics in the book.
I want to talk about your characters, of course, but before we do, I think you once said, maybe even said it to me, that a lot of the genesis of this novel was thinking, what would have happened to you if you'd stayed in Peru?
Yeah, I mean, there's an element of that. Certainly, my family's history mirrors a bit the history of the family described here. My family moved to Peru from Peru to the United States
To Alabama.
To Baltimore.
Alabama ultimately.
Ultimately to Alabama, but first to Baltimore. And there is something similar in that my older sisters were both born in the United States in Baltimore. When we moved back to Peru is when I was born. And so what I tried to imagine that would color that relationship between Francisco and Nelson was the disparity in passports, you know, which I lived in a very small way, which was just that when we would travel, you know, coming back to the United States, my sisters would breeze through customs, you know, with their blue passports, and then we would go, my parents and I, and wait with everyone else. I don't remember if they would wait on the side and snicker and make fun of us, but maybe not. We can ask. We can do some fact-checking on that. But that was the only way I lived it. But what if we'd stayed? You know? Yeah, and I think that then you start to wonder about the dynamics between two brothers and, you know, the competitiveness between two young men. Given the situation that Peru was in, if you had an escape hatch, if you had an American passport in the late 1980s and you were young, you would take it. You would take that escape hatch. And what would it do to you if you didn't have it?
You still, in many ways, think of yourself as a kind of hyphenated, hybrid American and Latin writer, or some fusion of the two, and yet, there's a lot, I hate to use the word magical realism because, you know, it's overused, but there's a lot of reminiscent evocations of writers like Borges in your work and Bolaño, but you're essentially more an American writer, really, aren't you?
Well, I mean, you know, I think of myself as an American writer who happens to write about Latin America and a Latin American writer who happens to write in English. And in Peru, you know, I don't necessarily think of myself as a Peruvian-American so much as I think of myself as Peruvian and American. Hmm. In that, you know, I'm not... like there is something, you know, there is a legitimate Mexican American culture, for example, or there is a Puerto Rican American culture, there's a Cuban American culture. Peruvians, I mean, there's relatively few of us, and I don't, except in Paterson, New Jersey, perhaps, there isn't really something that you could denote as this is Peruvian American culture. What we had growing up in Alabama was a dozen or two dozen loosely connected families that would get together on certain Peruvian national holidays to eat a tremendous amount of food and occasionally play soccer. And so I don't know if that is enough to call it a culture where I would say I'm Peruvian-American. I was in every respect a normal American guy. I was a normal American kid. I went normal American suburban middle-class kid going to, you know, normal suburban middle-class schools and playing soccer at the park and riding my bike and going, you know, going to the movies. And then we'd go to Peru and I was, you know, a normal middle class limeño, you know, like living in Lima with normal middle class people, you know, and I had two very distinct experiences that were as different as, you know, being in the ocean and being in the desert, very, very different cultural experiences. And so I don't necessarily use the hyphen because I don't think in this case it would work. You know, it's just an and.
Well, you actually have made some allusions to the fact that you grew up somewhat privileged, you say middle class, but I think, you know, the assumption often is with an ethnic name like yours or an ethnic background that maybe you're an impoverished Mexican background or from the barrio or something like that along those lines. It's a common thing that Americans do. They sort of stereotype you in some ways.
Well, yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I've had people seem very disappointed when they find out that we had lots of books in the house. you know, and that my parents are educated and professionals, and, you know, I had a like hoop in the driveway where I could shoot basketball, and, you know, and they think it's, you know, terrible that I had to go through that and still become a Latin American Latino writer. I think that one of the fallacies with which, you know, mainstream America, white America looks at Latinos and Latin Americans is, in this kind of simplistic and reductive sense, that everyone is the same. Everyone has the same background. Everyone has the same experience.
So this Hispanic umbrella.
Yeah, and it's really, of course, that's not the case. I think of myself as Latino as well, but you know, it's been, I think I'm fairly careful to note who I am and where I come from, just because I think it's unfair to people who did come from those situations for me to pretend that I am anyone except who I am.
I think of some of the Peruvian writers, I think of somebody like Vargas Llosa. He seems almost like a caballero, you know.
He's a patrician.
Yeah, patrician would be the right word too.
Yeah, I don't think of myself as patrician, but you know, it's different generations. He's of that generation. I had a guy I interviewed one time who said, "You know, young man, you know, look at you with your hair like that." He's like, "I'm from that generation that if we didn't wear a tie, we'd catch a cold." And I think Vargas Llosa is from that generation as well. You know,
why did you decide to grapple with this country of your imagination fused with a great deal of Peru after the war? What was there that drew you to that?
Well, after college, I was a public school teacher in New York for 2 years, and then I went back to Peru and I taught in a neighborhood on the edge of the city, a neighborhood in the district of San Juan de Rigancho. And I've written a lot about that time, early 2000s, because that's the time where I was most intensely, that I saw most vividly with my own eyes, right after the fall of Fujimori, the first year of Toledo, when it was like all the complaints of the people had been, no one had been protested for years because they were scared. No one had protested for years because they didn't want to be called Maoist, communist, terrorists, you know? And, you know, Fujimori had his ways of keeping people quiet without being, you know, a homicidal, you know, Pinochet type person. He still had his hands everywhere, and so the first year of Toledo was crazy. You know, you couldn't go to downtown. Every day you went through the old center of town, there were protests, and it was the most diverse group of protesters you've ever seen. You know, there'd be like the telephone workers who'd been lost their jobs, you know, the gynecologists, you know, the teachers, the veterinarians, you know, the union of, you know, shoe shiner, and, you know, whatever. And it was extraordinary. And, you know, I'm just coming there and I'm like, wow, this is really mad. This is absolutely mad, you know. And I lived in this neighborhood, San Juan de Rigancho, and I talked to the people who lived there, and they just told me all the stories of what the last 10 years had been like. And this was a neighborhood that had been founded only 15 years before or something. It was all under construction. It was all new. And of course, I just soaked it in. I ended up leaving my parents' apartment and moving to this neighborhood.
You just absorbed these stories?
So. Yeah, people just, you know, I think part because I was young, all the kids, you know, were like, who's that weird gringo guy? And they were just, you know, I played soccer, so I was always around. And you know, people just tell me things. I've always had that boat. I mean, people have always just wanted to tell me stories. I don't know.
Where'd the idea for Henry and the play come from?
From a playwright that I met in New York, named Walter Ventosilla. It used to be a great Spanish language bookstore in New York called Lectorum, and I went one day for a reading, and I met this guy, and I told him that I was moving to Peru and I was Peruvian. He was like, oh, give me a call and get there. And I did. And he introduced me to all his old friends who'd been part of this theater group called Septiembre. They were all 20 years older than me. They were all hilarious. They were all, they all had very, very outrageous stories about putting on plays in little mountain towns, and then the army comes and they have to run away, and then putting on the same play in another town, and then Shining Path comes and they have to run away, you know. You know, it was just incredible to hear their stories. And then one of them, a guy named Gustavo Lora, it's a friend of mine that I named Pata Larga, we ended up taking a trip together to from Lima to Ayacucho, then to Andahuaylas, and eventually not to Cusco City, but to around in the Cusco province. And that trip became the basis of the trip in the book. That was in 1990. When was that?
Did you go into the
2001?
I'm sorry. You want to catch your chronology here?
I'm not sure when it was. It was.
But did you go into the infamous prison? Did you experience that?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, and many times. Many times I spent a night in the prison, in fact. Mm-hmm. I was first invited to do a reading at the prison in 2000, must have been 2006 or 7. Mm-hmm. And the first time I went, I was just astonished by it. It looked like something out of Dante. And I just wanted to go back. I just had never seen anything like that in my life. And the first time I went, it was 11,000 men in a prison for, you know, had been built for 2,000, you know, and it was just outrageous. I'd never seen anything like it. I can't describe really the sensation of, I mean, I guess I did describe it, but just the way it felt to see all these people and so close and, you know, just you had to keep you looking around. It's like, what is going on here?
And quite an impact.
Huge impact, yeah. Yeah. And so then I just arranged to go back as often as I could. And then eventually, when my novel, the first draft, collapsed, I'd heard about this crazy thing there while I was there. One of the first visits I made, I asked an inmate that I met where he lived. And he said, I live in block 18, but I'd really like to live in block 7. I was like, why is that? And he's like, because they have democracy there. I was like, what are you talking about? So it turns out that block 7 was the international drug traffickers block. And because they had no local power structure, because it was like Polish and Israeli and South African and Brazilian and Colombian and Mexican, they had these kind of quasi-democratic elections. And so I'd heard this anecdote and I was like, I want to see that. And so I was in this crisis where I didn't know if I was going to be able to finish the novel. And I called up my editor at Harper's and I told him about this thing that I wanted to write. I want to go see this election. And they said, sure. And so I got on a plane and went to Lima and arranged to spend a night inside the prison to see the debate. They had a big debate inside this block of the prison. And I spent the night in the cell that one of the inmates lent me, and it was incredible. It was like, again, one of those situations that happens when you do journalism, where you find yourself in a place where you have no business being, and you think back to, you know, like, how did I get here? You know, this is incredible. I remember there was a guy giving a speech, and, you know, there's 400, 500 men in this, on three levels in the middle of this hallway. And on the top level is all the drug addicts who are just out of their minds, and they've all been paid to make noise. They've been given drums and they've been given shakers, and but they can't. They're so zonked out of their minds. They don't know. They keep forgetting who they're supposed to be cheering for. And just the spectacle of it was just you know, I'll just never forget that. I think it was one of the most interesting things I've ever seen. And of course, you write a piece like, you know, I wrote an 8,000-word piece for Harper's, and you know, I could have written it. 20,000 word piece for Harper's. There were so many interesting things that I saw. And they just ended up, when I went back to the novel in July of that year, I had all this extra material. And I realized that Henry had spent a lot of time in prison. And he knew this place. And I knew it now too. And so I could write it.
Talk a little bit about the difference for you, because you've done a lot of journalism. You've even done work on radio, which we like to call the theater of the mind. And I think I can announce this. Daniel's going to be taking a professorship in the journalism department at Columbia. He's abandoning us here and moving to New York. It's our loss, their gain. But you've done a lot of journalism and you've done a lot of fiction. And talk just about what goes on as a writer in the differences between actually trying to compile things from your imagination that are factual and then just giving your imagination the free rein that you do, say, in the novel.
It sounds counterintuitive, but the process is very similar. Mm-hmm. In that if I walk into a room and say it's a real room, I start paying attention to the things that I think are interesting about that room, and I start writing them down, and I start creating in my mind words to describe the scene of what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing. If I walk into a fictional room, I do the same exact thing. I step into a fictional room and I look and see who's there, what they're talking about, what's happening in front of me, the relationships between the people in the room, the power, the way they talk. You know, it's exactly the same. Of course, one is completely made up, and one you actually have to go physically and walk into a place. But once you're there, it's really not that different. It's really not that different. What is different, and I think far more of a leap, is writing for radio, is actually going into that room with a microphone and, you know, headphones on and trying to get people to talk with this weird recorder and a shotgun mic, and that is weird. But stepping into a room with a little notebook and then just trying to disappear, I mean, I love that. I love that. I miss it. You know, I try to do it as much as I can, because it's it is very much to me like very much like the process of writing fiction.
So let me ask you about what I think is a very important theme in your novel. I'm putting in my own, I suppose, professorial hat here, but I think the novel always struck me as, particularly because of the play and the play going, being revived and going across this Andean territory that you take us to and so forth, that has a lot to do with what a rather famous, not so much anymore, literary critic named Richard Poirier called the performing self, mm-hmm. the way we put ourselves out there and the way we have to be conscious of a performance, whether it's on the stage or off the stage. I think you were trying to talk about the representational on the stage and sometimes a thin line between particularly people who are doing acting yeah. or thespians, what they do in life.
Well, certainly in the case of Nelson, you know, he's trying on different personalities. He's trying on different identities. He's a kind of a character in search of a script in some ways. He's been spinning his wheels for so long that he's forgotten what it means to take agency over your life. So certainly there, we have a case of a young man who's lost his way and for whom theater becomes a way of life and his only viable skill, perhaps, but also a kind of psychological survival in his case. You know, you can look at a character like Henry and see that it's become much more corrosive and kind of destructive to him. But he too has looked for meaning in theater, looked for a way to transcend. I mean, you know, the reason why I chose theater as a metaphor or as a backdrop for this book is because it's so universal. I mean, you know, with a group of four-year-olds, if you say to them, you don't even have to say it to them, you just start acting. You know, you're like, oh, I'm going to be a little, I'd say to my 2-year-old, and I'm like, I pretend to be a zombie or pretend to be a robot, and I, you know, stomp around the house, and he gets it. We're pretending.
You don't scare him.
Oh, I terrify him, of course, you know. But then he comes back and he says, mas, mas, you know, there's more and more. I mean, of course, he runs away, hides, and then when I stop, he's like, what are you stopping for, man? I think that everyone understands across cultures that there are things that are inexplicable, things that are difficult, things that are powerful, that we don't talk about, we represent. We stand up and we pretend. We act them out in order to comprehend them. And you know, in a lot of ways, that's what Nelson's doing.
Getting back to fiction writing in general, you were given this award, a recipient of one of the New Yorker's, you know, finest writers, and you were pretty young. Mm-hmm. You know, they were trying to certainly select what they believe was a select crowd of young fiction writers. And I just wondered how that worked on you. I mean, it could make some writers very egotistical. I've never seen you as being anything other than a modest man, but was it a gift, was it a blessing, or was it maybe a blessing and a bit of a curse too?
When it happened, it was, and the thing is, like, I think it's those lists are silly and they're arbitrary and they're ridiculous, but it's much better to say that when you're on the list. You know, it's much more satisfying. You know, that actually happened at a very odd time for me, because it happened the summer of 2010. And I sent my agent wanted me to send something in, and I wasn't sure. They asked me to do it, and I was like, okay. But what I had was basically 3/4 of that draft that 4 months later I would be throwing in the trash. So I really didn't want to send it. But they insisted, and then, I ended up cobbling a story out of this book that I sort of felt in my heart was already doomed, you know? And so when it came out, I did feel like a fraud, like a total fraud. I thought that we'd put together a good story, but it felt very put together. It felt to me like it wasn't my best work. And I felt very much like a pretender. Over the year, my friend Robbie likes to say that he would put together the list of best American writers under 5'7", which would be a tough list because many of us are not very tall. But the lists are what they are. You know, they're a snapshot, and some snapshots come out blurry. I think it's a good list, but we could put together a list of 20 other writers that would be
to mention that this is quite honorific. Daniel's been selected also to decide who the National Book Award winner is going to be, which means he has to read about 300 books probably in the course of the year here. A very lofty and certainly terrific distinction to be part of that. When did you decide to include the love affair in your book?
Early on in that second draft, when I knew that Henry had been in prison, I knew that I was going to have to write that scene. And it came from an actual comment that an inmate made to me when I was visiting the prison. Because the prison economy is like a lot of Latin American prisons. When you arrive, you aren't given anything. You aren't promised a bed or a cell or food. You have to work or have money from the outside in order to have these things. Recently in Bogota, there's the Modelo prison there. An analyst at Universidad de los Andes did the calculations and figured out that the most expensive real estate in Bogota was the square meter in prison, because you have to pay for everything, every little thing, and not even just relative to the money that people have inside, but actually the square meter is the most expensive square meter in Bogota. So the prison economy was such that you don't own anything, and you probably end up having to rent a cell or rent a bed in a cell. And on visiting days, this man told me that of the many terrible smells in the prison, the worst was the smell of sex, when no one had come to visit you. And I asked him to explain, and he said, well, I don't own my cell, I rent it. And on visiting days, the owner of the cell kicks me out, and the guys whose wives or girlfriends come to visit use my cell as their place of recreation. And when I come back, I smell that, and I smell the loneliness of it. And it's the worst smell in the prison. There was no way to shoehorn that very dramatic description into that Harper's article, which was very much about the politics and the power structure of this block in the prison. But it was something that just stayed with me. And I knew when I realized that I was going to go back to the prison in a serious way, and that Henry was going to have spent some time there, I knew that was his backstory. And I knew that I would have to write that scene. And I did.
So what kind of response did you get in Peru with the Harper's article and with the novel?
Good. I mean, in general, I think in Peru, people, when they read me, they tend to like it. I think I've gotten very good responses in Peru. I wrote a book of stories that hasn't come out here in the States yet, but it came out in Peru, and I thought it was very weird, and it was great. I was very proud of it, but it wasn't very Peruvian, and that book in Peru just kind of doesn't exist. My two novels are very, the imaginary country that everyone knows is Peru, I'm very much considered a Peruvian writer.
You're on hiatus with novels now for at least a while as you acclimate to Columbia University?
It's not that. I mean, I'm sure that will be a challenge. It's not for any sort of work reason. It's just because what I want to do some something else. I mean, I mentioned again and again how much I enjoy those moments when you're reporting, when you disappear. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to disappear that way for a while.
I ask you a question that I asked a number of my students, taught the last class last week in this course I do in world fiction. And there are a lot of creative writing majors in there, people who really aspire to be writers. And I found myself asking, I've been teaching literature for over four decades. I had this group of young aspiring writers, and I said, tell me why you want to write. Tell me what's important to you about writing, why it's something that you're committed to, or why it's something you want to at least distinguish yourself in. Ask yourself that question? Or?
I don't. I think I used to justify, or you try to, but no, you know what? I don't. I just need to. And the thing is, like, now I don't think of myself as a novelist or as a story writer so much. I think of myself as someone who works in narrative. You know, in Spanish we say narrador, a narrator, storyteller, because I have been playing with so many different forms. I just really enjoy it. I mean, it's as hard as I work, it's basically hedonism, because I like what I do so much, And there's really.
Even when you throw out a whole draft.
Even when I throw out a whole draft, I guarantee, like you said, that I'm seem very modest and blah blah blah, and I may be, but I promise you, inside, when I tell people that I threw out a whole fucking draft of my book, my heart is like swelling with pride, because. I'm not going to go to war. I'm not going to go up and punch the biggest guy in the room in the face. And, I'm not going to jump off a bridge to, save a baby or whatever. I don't know, whatever heroic feat you can imagine. But in my world, as a writer, that's as heroic as it gets.
I'm interested that you use the word almost what I was not anticipating. I think you're describing a sense of honor, aren't you? Of what's honorable to you?
It is. I mean, if you know that it's not good enough, I mean, the world is full of crappy books, and no one needs mine. And my agent wanted to see it, my editors wanted to see it, and I wouldn't show it to them. I showed it to two friends who were, very honest with me. And yeah, it isn't. I think if I will permit me a moment of arrogance, yeah, that's one thing that I've done that I'm very proud of. I didn't show anyone that terrible book.
I guess we got to bring up the lights now and take any questions from the audience. I think opportunity is extended to write down.
Thank you. You got me to admit I was arrogant.
Well, I'd be very interested to know your thinking about how you ended the book.
Yes. I don't know how. I don't want to do spoilers here, but let me see. I knew that the narrator and the protagonist had to meet at a certain point, and I knew that that meeting had to be complicated, intense, and I wrote it very carefully. I wanted there to be, I want people ask me all the time, did Nelson do it or not? And I honestly don't know. I think what I was trying to do was convey the narrator's doubts. The narrator doesn't know either. And the best way I think to show that was to show it in scene, when Nelson arrives where he arrives, I suppose he has two choices. He can become of the place or he can shut down, and he's an actor, he's a chameleon. That's what he's studied. That's his only, that's his skill, and that his survival instinct tells him that's what he has to do. Now, the question that the reader is left with is he acting or is he not acting at the end, Is he pretending in order to get to make a point to the narrator? Or is that who he's become? Or is that who he always was? And I think that's a really, That's a really tough question. And I thought it would be dishonest of me to leave the impression that I knew the answer, because I don't. So sorry. Thank you.
I wasn't sure if you were an English speaker or a Spanish speaker when I started the book. Mm-hmm. And it sort of had a translated feel to me. Mm. And I wondered if you wrote entirely in English or maybe thought some in Spanish and translated it in your mind as you were writing, or I may be totally off base there, but that was just sort of the impression that I got, and I wondered if you could speak to that.
I write in Spanish, but this book was written all in English. Early drafts, the first, for example, you know, I grew up in Alabama, I know that was mentioned at the beginning. The first things that I ever wrote about Alabama, I wrote in Spanish. For some reason, was unable to write about the place in English, and I ended up writing in Spanish, and then translating some of that, and I think there's very brief mentions of Francisco in his sort of trajectory through the United States. In earlier drafts, that was much, much bigger. The first version of the book was much more about the relationship between the two brothers, and so there was stuff there that was, in some ways, translations of texts that I'd written in Spanish. But no, this book was written in English. I think that there is maybe something that I'm not even aware of that is a kind of latent below the surface Spanish grammar or syntaxis that's in my speech.
Do you dream
speech.
Only in English, or have you ever dreamed in Spanish?
Oh, I dream in Spanish all the time, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we speak Spanish at home. My wife is Colombian, and I probably speak more Spanish than English in the course of a day.
You said your child says mas.
Mas, yeah. He also says book, though. It says book. I'm trying to think. Today this is my first conversation in English of the day. So, for whatever that's worth. But I still got it.
Bienvenido. Yeah.
It's like riding a bike, you know? It's English.
Could you comment on the title and the source for the title? Is there another literary source for
yes,
the title?
Yes, there is. There is. I what am is a unabashed purloiner of ideas and phrases, and I just use them for inspiration all the time. And I was thinking a lot about Nelson. I was thinking a lot about theater, and I was reading a lot of theater in the years of 2008, 2009, 2010, reading a ton of theater. And I came across Guy Debord, the French philosopher, and I read The Society of the Spectacle, which, you know, I don't usually read philosophy, to be totally honest. I don't know if I understood most of the book, but I did feel that there were parts that were describing my character very well, and describing his, Nelson in particular, his inability to take agency, but only to express emotion, even, and only to be able to express emotion through the performance of other texts. You know, that's what I took from Guy Debord, and I just started looking up who was this guy, because I don't know anything about French contemporary French philosophers, and I came across an experimental film that he made called At Night We Walk in Circles and Are Consumed by Fire, which is in itself a translation of the longest palindrome in Latin, which I don't speak Latin, but it's the original phrase in Latin, At Night We Walk in Circles and Are Consumed by Fire, is a Latin palindrome. And so I just found that to be amazing, the image. And I just kept it in the back of my head. And then that night, when I was in the prison at Lurigancho, after the debate, which was extraordinary, I went out to the yard, you know, and this is not something that I'll ever get to do again, possibly, or I wouldn't have necessarily expected it, but, you know, after this thing, everyone's having a little food, and I'm in the prison yard, it's probably 11, and the men are out for a walk. The men are out for a walk, just And I remembered that phrase.
Didn't you want the narrative style to somewhat be circular too?
Yeah. Of course. There were so many echoes, and that's how you know a title works, you know? And I know you're looking for a title, and I'm going to help you with that. But when there's that many echoes, you know? When there's that many echoes, then you know that it's the right title for your book.
Thank you. I believe we have time. Just raise your hand, and we'll come to you for maybe one or two more at the most.
I kept thinking as I was reading the book of being reminded of novels where the hero has to go on a quest and there's a journey, and it struck me as being almost Homeric. I'm not sure that the character, it was hard to tell how Nelson developed because there was that echoing and circular thing. Did you have that in mind when you were writing?
Yeah, I mean, and I did, and in part because the first draft of the book, one of its great failures, and it had numerous, was that it was very static. You know, Nelson's search for a script for his life had reached the point of stasis. You know, he had basically given up searching, and it was very difficult to narrate with any sort of dynamism or energy. A sense of absolute drift. And so when I threw out the book and I started over, I said, okay, how can I narrate this sense of drift without having the novel itself be, you know, frankly boring? And I said, well, at least I'll give myself the illusion of movement and hopefully discover movement along the way if I tether the plot of the novel to this tour. So now Nelson might be feeling all the same things, but I'm going to put him in motion. I really did think in this kind of very schematic way, because you know, after you've spent 4 years on a novel and you've discovered it's boring, then you really want to do the opposite. And I just did put him in motion. And you know, there's the old saw that there's only two plots. There's a stranger comes to town and a man goes on a trip. And of course, the joke is they're the same plot told from different points of view. And I just decided to put away to stop trying to be cute. You know, I just wanted to tell the story. And I wanted the story to be about this man, this young man, Nelson, at a point in his life where he's drifting, where he has thrown away the woman he loves for out of sheer callowness and is colliding with his hero and his hero's past. You know, I'm just like, that's what's going to tell the story. And it did end up taking the form of a journey because I quite deliberately wanted motion. You know, I just wanted motion. I don't know that I was thinking of Homeric epics, but you know, there is something about that landscape. You know, mountains are not you can't look at a mountain and not think about your smallness. The way same, you can't look at the ocean and be unmoved. And I think that's part of the epic, is realizing that you're very small.
I think last question.
Do you see? I guess the question is how you see Henry in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question is about Henry and that Henry doesn't feel like he moves. I think he degenerates, he deteriorates. You know, he doesn't improve. I think that he had done a fairly passable facsimile of kind of conventional sanity for many years, without actually being at peace with what happened and what the part he had played in Rogelio's, you know, death, and what he didn't do to honor what was actually love, not just comfort, but real love. And I think that there's a number of reasons why he didn't ever admit to himself that he loved Rogelio, or that he so quickly forgot it when he left the prison. And I think all those things come back in ways that after the tour, you know, he's the one who's most damaged by that tour. You know, he goes back and inadvertently gets his protege, you know, essentially kidnapped, and then is left with the, you know, this, you know, these ashes and this trauma that he thought he'd put away forever.
Let me thank all of you, and thank Book Passage, and thank Dominican, and especially thank Daniel, and hope that there will be much more work from him to come. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Mike.